Is the minimum wage good or bad? How did it begin? And who does it affect? Today we talk to an expert, Michael Tennant from The New American, to shed some light on what this really does to our economy and to the poor. Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Today on Homefront, we have a spectacular guest. I bring to you an expert on the minimum wage. His name is Michael Tennant. He's a freelance writer from Michigan. And thank you, Michael, for being with us today. How is the weather up in Michigan?
Today it's nice and sunny and warm, and I'll probably be out in the pool later.
Sounds good. My in-laws used to live in Michigan, and we made many trips up there. So let me tell you how you came on my radar screen. I spent 8 years in the Missouri State Legislature, and I still, even though we have term limits, as I know you do in Michigan as well, term limits mean that after you've become educated on all the issues, you have to go bless the world somewhere else. So what am I going to do with all this great information except to continue writing my weekly newsletter? And I have this podcast that a lot of people enjoy hearing because we have the little known facts that you're not going to get in mainstream media. One week I wrote on the minimum wage, and somebody from The New American contacted me and said, you have to talk to Michael Tennant. He is fabulous and quite an extensive expert on minimum wage. So thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm not sure I'd say I'm quite an extensive expert on it. I've written on it, but I'm not an economist or anything. I'm just a writer. I look at what other people have done for research on it and sort of compile it all and put it into an article. But I'll do my best to answer whatever questions you come up with.
Well, in a sense, we're all economists because we all manage our own economy. We get money, take in and spend it, put out, and then we have to make our own decisions. And government is based on how the legislators decide to spend our money. So here we have the biggest struggle, and I'm going directly to the heart of the philosophy behind minimum wage. It really isn't anything to do with economics. This is where we fall into trouble, is people think it has something to do with money, but it really has to do with the emotional factors surrounding what do you owe to other people, what do you think they deserve, and how compassionate are you anyway? So we've got this stigma attached to anybody who dares to speak against the minimum wage, as you must not care about poor people. Of course, the Bible says we're all supposed to take care of poor people if we can, help them, help those lesser fortunate souls who are out there trying to eke out a living. So there's a tendency for all governments to be sympathetic toward minimum wage. Now, I feel sorry for you in Michigan because I know that your legislature is dominated by the Democrats, so you don't have as many expected victories as we have in Missouri with a supermajority of Republicans in both the House and Senate. Every time anything on minimum wage comes to the floor, it always passes. Can you first start by talking to us about compassion and how misplaced compassion has resulted in the mess we're in?
Oh, that's a broad question. But yeah, I think you're on the right track with what you were saying. You know, compassion is not something you can legislate. It's not something that you can force people to do. You know, compassion has to come from within. And it's compassionate for me to give something to somebody, but it's not compassionate for me to take something from you to give to somebody, you know? And that's kind of how the whole minimum wage thing is about, forcing an employer to pay what you think is a fair wage to somebody else. Thereby appropriating his property, you're not really being compassionate in that sense. You're just legalizing theft, in a sense.
Well, let's start with the history of minimum wage. Where did that idea come from, and how did we get to where we are today?
Well, at the federal level, the first minimum wage passed in the 1930s, and there were two ways of looking at this. There was the Davis-Bacon Act was the first sort of minimum wage, but it applied only to federal projects. But Thomas Sowell points out that before this Davis-Bacon Act was enacted, the black unemployment rate was lower than the white unemployment rate. But the people enacting the Davis-Bacon Act in part said they were doing this to force the wages to go up, so because what you had to do under the act was to pay the local prevailing wage for whatever, you know, the project was. So if a black was willing to work for less than white, well, now he can't anymore because the law says you have to pay this certain prevailing wage. So that was the whole point of that, or part of the point of that, was to prevent blacks from undercutting whites and getting jobs. And as Sowell pointed out, once that happened, once that law went into place, suddenly the black unemployment rate went up, and it has never been lower than the white unemployment rate since then. So that was the first thing. There was this whole move on federal projects, which was partly motivated by racism. And then later on, I think just as kind of part of the whole New Deal idea of the government can take care of you and employers are being cruel, we had the first federal actual minimum wage that applied to the private sector that was enacted and said you have to pay a certain amount for people that you hire.
And when did that pass?
1938.
So this was all pre-World War II, when our country appeared to be moving closer to socialism all the time.
Right. Yes, it was, you know, it was all New Deal socialist era stuff, yes.
Somehow we get the impression that we are now moving closer to socialism, and yet back then we thought we were so much more free market. So it shocks people of my generation to look back and ask, how could they have been so foolish?
The interesting thing about FDR, he came into office promising to undo most of what Hoover had done, and really, Hoover was doing the same thing. You know, everybody says, oh, Hoover was this great laissez-faire guy, and that's the reason the Depression happened, because he didn't do enough. But no, Hoover started all the same kinds of things that Roosevelt just expanded on. But when Roosevelt ran for office, he promised to cut spending and cut regulations and all of this stuff, got into office and just did a complete 180 and started expanding. But the thing is, that was in vogue at the time, too. I mean, the things that were going on in Germany as far as economics and Germany and Italy in terms of fascism and all that was all the rage. So Roosevelt wasn't doing anything that was different in economic terms from what was going on in those countries, but then that got tainted, and so, you know, by association with Hitler and Mussolini, and so things, you know, they've kind of, over the years, changed the approach to it to make it look a little less fascist or socialist. But, yeah, I mean, that was definitely the thing that was going on at the time.
So how do we get freedom back in vogue?
Well, people never want to, how do I put this? It's never really gone out of, socialism has never really gone out of vogue. It's just been put in, you know, under different terminology, the Great Society or compassionate conservatism, even as, you know, George W. Bush put it. But it's, people want something for nothing, you know, and so government promises to give you X by taking it from somebody else, well, that's pretty attractive. It's a lot easier than having to work for it and do the hard work of building up savings or getting an education that will help you to improve yourself.
So here we are today. Let's fast forward. I want to tell you a story of what happened on the House floor in the Missouri State House of Representatives. There was a citizens' initiative that threw a petition put on the ballot a minimum wage hike that was indexed and did not put any exception in there for the wait staff. So all the waiters and waitresses, anybody who gets tips, previously the employer was allowed to calculate their tips as part of their wages so that they could get their minimum wage. Because the Citizens Initiative petition did not include any exception for those types of mathematical figures, it meant that every waiter and waitress had to make the minimum wage plus tips. So we had an opportunity in the legislature to do a modification to this statute to make the correction. And I remember all the people from the Restaurant Association came to the Capitol to encourage us to do the right thing so that their industry wouldn't take a hit and have to raise all their menu prices. And yet when we were debating it on the House floor, there were people who stood up and argued that this would hurt poor people. One of the representatives painted a picture of this single mother who's a waitress slinging hash, just trying to eke out a living. And if we try and make this modification, it will hurt her. It appalled me because, of course, if I were a single mother, I would not like that slinging hash attached to me. Not all single mothers sling hash. It just creates some negative imagery. But nevertheless, that speech was so effective that in the long run, the legislators at the end of the day could not muster enough votes, even though the Republicans were in the majority. So how do we get past this perception that we're going to hurt poor people if we rein in the minimum wage and don't raise it?
Well, there's a whole bunch of stuff in there that kind of comes out of what you mentioned. First of all, let's be clear in this. There are very few people that match that description of the single mother slinging hash or whatever she's doing at minimum wage, you know, trying to raise a family and, you know, at the minimum wage. It's just not the case. In my article, I quoted Mark Wilson of the Cato Institute, who wrote that the popular belief that minimum wage workers are poor adults working full-time and trying to raise a family is largely untrue. Just 4.7% of those who are earning the minimum wage match that description. So, first off, you're not going to be hurting that many. I mean, you're not going to hurt or help a huge number of people that are really trying to raise a family on the minimum wage. Most of the people earning the minimum wage are teenagers and low-skilled workers who are at their first job, and, you know, even most of them are going to get a raise within their first year. So that whole perception that we're helping or hurting families is pretty much bogus. Now the other question is, well, what happens if we raise the minimum wage? We're going to put people out of work. I mean, it's just that simple. You know, it's just like anything else. You raise the price of gasoline, people drive less. Well, if you raise the price of labor, people are going to hire less labor. So you're going to hurt poor people, the people who need those minimum wage entry-level jobs the most, because they're the ones who are worth the least to employers in the first place. I mean, if right now, let's say you're worth $8 an hour to an employer. Well, okay, the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. Maybe he'll hire you. But if you're worth $8 an hour and the minimum wage is raised to $10 an hour, why would an employer hire you? He's going to lose $2 an hour for every hour you're on the job. You're going to put people out of work if you force employers to pay them more than they're worth. It's not going to help people. In fact, there was a review in 2005. David Newmark, Mark Schweitzer, and William Washer did a study on this, and they concluded, quote, the net effect of higher minimum wages is to increase the proportion of families that are poor and near poor. These people are being put out of work, and not only that, as you mentioned, the price of restaurant food is going to go up because they have a lot of minimum wage staff, so price of other things goes up too. So the poor people not only are getting less work, less income, but then they're having to pay higher prices on top of it.
Hi friends, do you like what you're hearing? Then go to my website. It's CynthiaDavis.net and sign up for my newsletter. You'll get all this information and more when you sign up for my email reminding you of when you'll hear another podcast and letting you know what's coming up next. Besides, we always have a little bit of humor at the end, so go to CynthiaDavis.net and stay in the loop. For those of you who don't like email, go to my Facebook page. It's called Homefront with Cynthia Davis. And make sure you click the like button. That way, you'll have a convenient way to see what we're doing and to get the word when another podcast is released. That's Homefront with Cynthia Davis on Facebook. my website is CynthiaDavis.net. That's where we keep all our good stuff. So if you want to get our newsletter and find more podcasts, go to CynthiaDavis.net. Hey, let's stay in touch. Okay, Michael, one thing I particularly enjoy about your perspective is that you're helping us bring it down to reality. I was surprised when I sent out my newsletter that I received several negative responses. And we need to be brave and tough and tell the truth, regardless of where it takes us. I'd like to read this letter to you. In my newsletter to my constituents, I brought up the story of Seattle that raised their minimum wage to $15 an hour and the ramifications we can expect from that. So here's a response, some pushback I got from my constituent. He says, Cynthia, I enjoyed reading your newsletter emails and I am a conservative, but I am a realistic person, and I have to tell you that most of your arguments against raising the minimum wage are just not very good or convincing. There are some negative consequences to raising the minimum wage, namely the inflation it inevitably causes, but most of your points just don't hold water. First, people who make $15 an hour or less hardly pay any income taxes anyway, and if they have any dependents, they pay none. So there is no huge windfall tax revenue incentive for politicians to push this issue. Second, Seattle's problems lie in the fact that their minimum wage is higher than surrounding areas. If the federal minimum wage was $15 an hour, then there is no geographic conflict. The Seattle situation only strengthens the argument that all cities and states need the same minimum wage. Third, employers who pay only the minimum wage do so because of their desire to hold labor costs to a minimum. If they could get less people to accomplish the same work, they would already be doing so. Part of the problem is that the minimum wage employees usually are required to work harder and faster than people with knowledge and skills. The hardest job I ever had in my life was working as a fry cook at Steak and Shake back in the 70s. I had to work an absolutely brutal pace. My next job was a dishwasher at a large commercial restaurant, and it was at least as bad. There already is very little job satisfaction in minimum wage employment. I'm not sure it could get any worse. So I'd like to, here are a number of issues for you, Michael, if you could respond to what sticks in your mind when you read this kind of stuff.
Well, I question whether someone, person identifies as a conservative, but do you, if you think that the government, are you conservative if you think that the government has the right to interfere with private contracts and private property? You know, if an employer offers me $5 an hour and I'm willing to work for $5 an hour, whose business is it to tell me that I can't work for that? I'm going to tell the employer that he has to pay me more. And, you know, that's the one thing I would question. Another thing, I don't think many politicians are interested in the higher minimum wage because it brings in more taxes. I think they're interested in it because they're being pushed by interest groups like labor unions who benefit because, A, it pushes up the price of their competing labor that's non-union, and B, a lot of unions have contracts that are tied to the minimum wage so that if minimum wage goes up, all of their members' wages have to go up. Large employers sometimes like the increase in the minimum wage because it helps them against competition. Like Walmart, for example, generally pays above minimum wage already. So they have in the past, at least, I'm not sure about the current move to increase the minimum wage, but in the past, they've supported it. Why? Because if their competitor down the street is paying minimum wage and Walmart is paying more, well, force the minimum wage up and now their competitor has to pay higher wages and reduces that competitor's edge against Walmart. So you've got all these pressure groups. I think that's more where politicians like to grandstand and show that they're compassionate, as we keep saying. You know, they want to show that they are trying to help the poor. Uniformity of tax rates across things rather than, okay, Seattle raises theirs, and that's a disadvantage because neighborhoods nearby don't have that high minimum wage. Well, what you're saying is if if Seattle raises their minimum wage and it's going to cause unemployment there because people in neighboring areas don't have that minimum wage, well, if we raise the minimum wage uniformly across the country, you've got that much more unemployment everywhere. People have nowhere to go then. You know, if I live in Seattle and the minimum wage is too high for me to get hired there, but I can go to somewhere across the state and get hired at a lower minimum, well, now I have a job. Whereas if the minimum wage is $15 an hour everywhere, nobody will hire me. I'm out of work. So I don't think that's a good argument either. Well, of course employers want to keep their labor costs to the minimum. Let's put it this way. Don't you want to keep your costs to a minimum? I mean, if I've got two plumbers who will do the same job, and one plumber that I, and they're both good plumbers, I know they have, they come highly recommended. One of them will do the job for $100 and the other one will do the job for $200. Which one am I going to hire? Which one would you hire?
Well, of course, the one who does it.
Employers are doing the same thing that we all do. We all try to keep our costs to a minimum, of course. But employers, just as we might do, would hire, might replace you instead of, you know, you get replaced by an automated machine because machines are cheaper and they don't complain about their wages. And they,
right,
aren't subject to minimum wage law. I don't think any of those are necessarily good arguments. They're more emotion-based rather than fact and reason-based. And we're trying, as you said, we're trying to stick to the hard facts of this, even though they are hard and they don't sound pretty. Sounds like you don't like poor people. You know, you want them to earn $2 an hour and work in sweatshops, but, you know, that's not what it is. It's just the facts.
Well, here's what also is going on. There are a lot of people who believe the employers are the greedy ones, that they are not out to help their employees. They're here to make more profit. And therefore, if we will raise the minimum wage, you will see more of the employers saying, well, I guess I'll forego my vacation this year so I can pay more in wages. Or you'll see them give up more of their profit margin. Does that really happen?
No, generally they do a variety of things to avoid having to pay more, just again, as you and I would do things to avoid having to pay higher prices. They will hire fewer people, and we've had surveys out of businesses now that say, you know, you raise the minimum wage, I'm going to cut my hiring and I'm going to lay people off because I can't afford to pay more. There are those who will keep their jobs even though the minimum wage has gone up, but those people are likely to get fewer other benefits from their employers, you know, and they may see on-the-job training cut, they might see whatever insurance, you know, they have to pay more for their own insurance or whatever, because the employers aren't just going to sit there and take it any more than anybody else would.
It's great to talk about these concepts in the theoretical sense, but do you have any concrete examples of where a reduction in minimum wage has created more jobs or where an increase has created less?
Well, as a matter of fact, it's been the case ever since the first minimum wage back in 1938 was passed, that it's always created unemployment. Cato Institute report that I was quoting earlier, they wrote, evidence of employment loss has been found since the earliest implementation of the minimum wage. The U.S. Department of Labor's own assessment of the first 25-cent minimum wage in 1938 found that it resulted in job losses for 30,000 to 50,000 workers. Or that comes to 10 to 13% of the people who were covered at that point. So right away, people are losing jobs.
How about welfare? Can you explain this one to me? A lot of people who are in favor of the minimum wage believe if we could just make the private sector pay their employees more, then we would have fewer people on welfare, and therefore there'd be a savings to the taxpayer. Comment on that.
Well, if you could do that, I mean, sure, if you could get people getting paid more, yeah, they wouldn't have to collect welfare, but you can't just legislate higher wages. Higher wages come from increased productivity. If I'm worth $5 an hour right now and over time, I develop skills on the job that make me worth $7 an hour, well, my wages are going to go up to reflect that. But you can't just, I mean, if we could legislate that employers pay everybody enough so that nobody's on welfare, well, why don't we just make the minimum wage $100 an hour and then nobody would be poor anymore?
Yeah, how about that?
And in fact, if you did that, there would be mass unemployment. It just would not work. People have to be paid based on their worth to their employers. People often say to people who want to support the increase in minimum wage, well, why don't you just raise it? And they realize at that point they can't do that because it would cause unemployment. But if you just raise it a little bit, well, you're still going to hurt a few people, but not as many. But those people that are hurt are still hurt.
Right. When the Republicans were caucusing and we had the discussion of what do we do, we were told that minimum wage is supported by 80% of the population. Therefore, if any of us want to go against what's that popular, we're asking for ourselves to get voted out of office. Another point is labor is so militant, they will come after any elected official who votes against them and have done that many times. They're capable of coming against anyone who votes against their issues. So those two factors, the intimidation from labor and the point that even among conservatives, minimum wage is a popular idea, or so-called conservatives, how do we overcome this and how do we educate the public if nobody in office is willing to speak out about the economic detriment this creates?
And I think it's helping that we have the internet now and other alternative means to what's reported in, you know, the so-called mainstream media. It used to be all you ever heard was the pro-minimum wage side. Now we do have outlets like the New American, which of course has existed since before the internet, but I mean they have their website now, which reaches many more people. You have various other websites that, you know, actually report against it. You've got your podcast, you have other people with radio shows and internet radio shows. It's just a matter of getting the information out, but it's tough because it's an emotional appeal to voters. People don't like the thought that poor people aren't making as much money as other people are and that businesses are ripping them off to get a profit. But, you know, voters support Social Security and Medicare and all these other things that aren't good ideas either. But we just don't give up on trying to convince them otherwise. We just have to keep plugging.
That's good. The name of our show is Homefront, and we talk about the intersection of public policy with how it affects the family. One of the greatest disappointments I've had in this entire debate is people are discounting that there even is such a thing as the family. It's as if the family's completely invisible. So when people ask the question, can a person live on $7.50 an hour? The answer is that would be very difficult if you have no friends or family. But if you take a husband and wife who are both making $7.50 an hour, now you're taking in the net effect of 15 an hour. Or if it were 15 an hour per person, now it's as if they're taking in 30 an hour. And the more people who want to contribute to that, the easier it is to exist and to live. So one of the points of the minimum wage is if we keep talking about the individual and can he afford an apartment, why is it society's job to make sure that everybody can live without the comfort or friendship of a family?
Well, it isn't, but we've gotten to this point where families being broken up, and, you know, it is a lot tougher these days than it used to be because you have so many people that are single parents or just kind of living out there on their own because they grew up in a dysfunctional family or maybe had only one parent.
But that's
it's tougher now than it used to be, but it's not impossible.
But you know what? That's not government's job. And we will never be able to make up for bad personal choices of the population. And this, I think, is where the discussion has gotten off track, at least in many legislatures. People make bad personal choices, and I'm not speaking to anybody specifically, but in an aggregate, we have less morality, we have more bad decisions, and people are suffering the consequences of their bad moral decisions. So then government feels like it needs to step in and make up for their bad decisions, and that is where we run into problems.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. you definitely have that issue where people are making, now some of it is encouraged by government policies like welfare and so forth, but yeah, it really does come down to a lot to personal responsibility for your own actions, and not depending on the government to take care of you when you, you know, when you mess up.
So speak to the country for a minute. If you could give us advice on one point, what is the way out? How do we encourage ourselves to get better than this? And give us some answers.
Well, one thing is at the federal level is to look at the Constitution. It's fairly clear, if you read in there, there's nothing in there about the federal government deciding what private sector employers can pay. That's just that simple. It shouldn't even be in existence at the federal level. And then you've got to deal with the economic and other arguments. But that's the first thing I would say, is that at the federal level, it should go. And right now, it doesn't appear to be getting very far in the federal, in Congress anyway. I mean, you've got, and it's a lot of partisanship, I think, more than principle. You've got Republicans in charge of the House, and it's Obama and the Democrats that are mostly pushing for the minimum wage. And it doesn't look like that's probably going to happen there. But I doubt that. I suspect that a lot of the Republicans in Congress really aren't opposed to it so much on principle as they're just opposed to it because it's Obama's idea. But, yeah, definitely pressure them not to do it. You know, you can call your representatives and your senators and tell them this is a bad idea. So that's kind of where I'd take it at the federal level. At the state and local level and everywhere else, you're going to have to deal with, as you said, the pressure from the constituencies who want it. And you're going to have to deal with all these economic arguments, which there are a lot more in my article than we have time to discuss today. But the whole idea of the fact that it causes unemployment and the fact that it's not really helping the poorest of the poor. Often, many of the people who are beneficiaries of higher minimum wages are teenagers who come from relatively well-off families who are getting summer jobs and part-time jobs and so forth. It's not the people that you think you're helping. In fact, you're hurting them by, you know, taking them out of work and getting them replaced by machines and higher skilled workers.
Okay, well, that's a great piece of admonition. Do you think there's, if you were president of the United States, would you just recommend the repeal of the Davis-Bacon Act?
Well, yes, that too, absolutely. you know, because all it does is, Davis-Bacon, at this point, I don't think is really having the racial effects that it did at the time so much, but it's still causing taxpayers more anyway, if nothing else, because it's forcing wages higher than they might be if you had competitive bidding on projects like that. I would be for getting rid of that, too.
Well, Michael, thank you for being with us today and shedding some light on a topic that many people are intimidated against sharing because they feel like it's too complicated. So if you want to read more, we can go to thenewamerican.com. That's thenewamerican.com and read some of your other articles. It sounds like you've done a huge amount of research for us, and that's a true gift. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Will you be on our show again sometime?
Sure, if you want me, I'll be here.
Okay, that's a plan. We'll talk to you later. Thanks, Michael.
Okay, bye.
Goodbye. This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.